This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Ana Lucia Araujo, professor of history at Howard University. We're discussing her new book, The Gift: How Objects of Prestige Shaped the Atlantic Slave Trade and Colonialism. Ana follows the journey of an 18th century ceremonial silver sword that tell the story of the French trade and enslaved people in West and West Central Africa. A microhistory with an awareness of global currents, The Gift offers greater insight into the brutal and dehumanizing processes of the Atlantic slave trade and colonialism in Africa. Ana, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Khalid.
Of course. You know, this book is really fascinating on a couple levels. You know, microhistories I always find interesting, especially microhistories that take broader context into perspective. You know, I like to think about it, it's almost like, you know, with physics, how there's the focus on the very micro, you know, quantum level, and then also the broader, you know, the universe at large, and I always think that going from the very small to the large is a very valuable way to think, because we kind of as humans exist somewhere in between. But before talking about the book, I was just wondering if you just tell us a little about yourself and your background.
Yes, then my background, I am a historian, then a historian who focuses on the Atlantic slave trade and its slavery. I was trained as a historian in Brazil, in Canada, and also in France. And I also, then I have a PhD in history, but I also had a previous PhD in art history. Then this kind of work that I am doing in this book is the kind of work that allows me to draw on my two specialties, then my two disciplines, then that I was trained as, then art historian and also as a historian. And I have been teaching at Howard University for about 15 years. Then the work that I do is mainly then on the history of slavery and the Atlantic slave trade, with a particular focus on West Africa and Brazil initially, and then now I am doing much more comparative work, always with a focus on visual culture and also on how slavery is memorialized in the public space and also in museums as well.
So for this particular book, what was the inspiration? Was there a moment when you knew that you had the idea for the book that sort of started to come together?
Yes. Then this book, the way it was born is interesting. Then by 2007, when I finished this second PhD in history, it was a moment when in France, in Paris, just 1 year before then in 2006, there was the Quai Branly Museum that was unveiled at the time. And I had a project at that point of looking at the demands of restitution of African heritage to Western museums. Because when the museum Quai Branly was created, Then there was this public debate in French newspapers about the restitution, because these are museums that then gather and display then a large number of objects and artworks that were indeed brought during the period of French colonial rule and European colonial rule in general in the African continent. And I had this project as a postdoc, which indeed it ended up, I received funding for that, but I just used for about 6 months and not for the entire 2 years, because I got this job at Howard. Then when I moved to Howard, then of course in a tenure track position, I had then to work to publish my first book, which was based on the second dissertation that I wrote. Then I abandoned that postdoc project at that point. At some point by 2015, I started writing a book on the demands of reparations for slavery. And that is another story, but the book was published in 2017. And when I published that book, I told to myself, well, perhaps now it would be the time to write a book about the demands of a restitution of African heritage, then to take that back, that that project of then almost a decade before. And I started doing that work. Then I did research in Portugal, did research in Belgium and in France in particular, did also some research here in the United States at the Brooklyn Museum. And then my goal was really to look at the lists and objects, African objects that these museums had, and to see how to address the then to see if I was able to find then or to dress a sort of general history of the demands of restitution of African heritage. When I was in the process of then looking at different objects and then possibly then demands of restitution, a colleague who works at the Kebhani Museum, then as a curator there, she showed me the object that is on the cover of my book. Indeed, this object was in her dissertation that she defended in 2015, but she put the object in the annexes of her dissertation, and it was just a picture of the object. She didn't analyze, because this object emerged by 2015 in an auction. And the object has an inscription, and she saw that there was the term Cabinda, that is a port in West Central Africa, and it was colonized then in the 19th century. Then the Portuguese took over this region, and then she associated Cabinda with people who speak Portuguese, and me being Brazilian as a person who could perhaps elucidated the story of this sort. And I started digging that story, and I had done already work on the French presence in Brazil, also then the French presence, French colonization in the Bight of Benin, in what is present-day Republic of Benin. And I decided to only work that there was an interesting story about this object that led me to restrict my interest and look at only at this object instead of working with the large demands of restitution. Also because the story of the object itself challenges all the problems of demands of restitution of African heritage, because it's an object that it was fabricated in France, but was sent to West Central Africa, and it was looted about two times before it ended up then in where it is today in a French museum in La Rochelle.
So, you know, I think we'll definitely get to talking more about this sword and its really bizarre, fascinating journey that you track. But just sort of starting from a basic level, you know, I think everyone has some cursory understanding of the Atlantic slave trade. But I think it's valuable to think to just start a little bit with the origins to understand how the French ended up getting involved. So w would you mind talking a little bit at the first chapter where you look at the origins of the Atlantic slave trade, particularly on the Luango Coast where you focus and how the slave trade began in this region?
Yes, and of course that there was a slave trade that existed internally in the African continent before the arrival of the Europeans. Also, there was an internal trade of ivory and iron and other items in this region, as well as it happened across the African continent. Then the African continent was connected to the world already at the moment when the Atlantic slave trade emerged. But in this region, that is the Luango Coast, that covers part of what is present-day Angola and part of what is present-day Congo. This region is the region north of the Congo River. And the first Europeans to reach this region in the late 15th century are the Portuguese that pretty much initiated the Atlantic slave trade along the coasts of West Central Africa and West Africa. They were also the first to arrive in this region. Then they were present in this region since the late 15th century, but they established then settlements, permanent settlements south of the Congo River in the two areas that became, let's say this way, simplifying, two areas that became the two main slave trading ports in this region. Then during the era of the Atlantic slave trade, these ports are Luanda and Benguela, then south of the Congo River. But the Portuguese, they had an eye at least on the Luango Coast for a while. And with their arrival and the competition that was going on between the Portuguese and other European powers, especially the Dutch started also trading in this region, then not purchasing enslaved people at this point. They were trading in textiles, they were trading in iron as well. But with the development of the Americas and a plantation economy in the Americas, and with the fact that the Dutch will also get their slice in the Americas, then in the region of the Caribbean, they started gradually then this sort of shift from these first commodities that they were trading in the region, and started then purchasing enslaved Africans to be sold in the Americas. Then this is how the slave trade emerges in this region, pretty much as it happened in other areas of West Africa and West Central Africa. But here is important for us to have in mind that north of the Luango Coast, by then the 17th century, which is the period when the Atlantic slave trade launches in the region, we are going to have three main states, three main kingdoms, that these were centralized states. They were structured societies. Then these were not decentralized or stateless communities. They had three kingdoms, then the Kingdom of Luango, Kingdom of Kakongo, and Kingdom of Ngoio, which is this last one. Ngoio is the kingdom that I look at because each of them had ports that were then seaports. And it's in these areas, then the coastal areas where the trade with Europeans will take place. And of course, for that to happen, and as you are referring here to organize the states, we have, of course, these are monarchies, then we have noblemen, we have enslaved people, we have commoners, and the noblemen, of course, include a king, but the king also has a different officers, people who occupy different offices. representing the king at different levels. And these include, of course, people who were in contact with the Europeans. Then this contact in the beginning is a contact to trade different kinds of commodities, but with the rise of the Atlantic slave trade, these middlemen or intermediaries, they become those who are trading in people, then who are getting the captives from the interior mainly, and offering these captives then to the European traders who get in the region. Then the first are the Portuguese that are there, but in the very beginning, late 15th century, but the Dutch, we start this trade, then we start trading in people. And gradually you are going to see other European powers arriving in the region. Then the French, the English, and then the British will get there as well. And then the Portuguese, eventually even the Brazilians, then Brazilian-born slave traders will get to this region. And this later on in the 19th century, which is not really a period that I really cover in the book. The book is most centered on the 18th century, at least in that area of the Luangwa coast.
You briefly mentioned the role of the middleman who's responsible for getting the enslaved people and then trading them, the Mafuka. Can you tell me a little bit about this role, how they participated in the slave trade, what type of person occupied it, their responsibilities?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is a great question. Then in different ports along the African coasts, there were these intermediaries, and there were more than one of them, but the Mufuka is an individual that was described by the European, because part of the work that we do here is based a lot on European accounts, and of course sometimes we have to be careful with this kind of source, but in the Dutch sources, French sources, Portuguese sources, British sources, the Mufuka appears as an office occupied by the man who is not a noble. He is a commoner, and it's a man. Then it's not, these are offices occupied by males, and is a man then who lives on the coast, and who is in charge. He is described as being the minister of commerce then by the Europeans. Then he is in charge of everything related to trade. Trade in the beginning, not the trading people, but then a trade in enslaved people. And then he would play this role of receiving then ship captains who arrived on the coast, allowing them to establish themselves with temporary structures on the coast. This man would receive tributes from European traders who arrived on the coast. Then these tributes were usually items that were used as currencies to purchase enslaved people. Then I'm referring here, for example, to textiles, to alcohol, to iron bars, to even weapons at some point. But in addition to these tributes, these individuals who were the Mufuka and these intermediaries, they started also accepting what we can call gifts. Then the gifts, the category of the gift is a tricky one, because it refers at the same time to these tributes that were customary along the African coasts, but also include other items that were then fancy items that sometimes were made of precious metals, then or hair, textiles, and in some cases they were fabricated only to be offered to these individuals. As the Atlantic slave trade started developing, intensifying, especially in the 18th century, these individuals that are called the Mufuka, then there was. Then more than one in these different kingdoms, but the Mufuka becomes an individual that becomes wealthier with the intensification of the trade, because he could accept, he was in contact with the Europeans, he could accept these gifts, he could accumulate this wealth, which the king who lived in the interior could not. Then the king, especially in the case of Ngoi, is described as an individual who could not, that had a sacred role. He could not be seen eating, for example, and he could not accept these European gifts. Then as the trade intensifies, these kings are more and more alienated in detriment of these individuals who were commoners and who lived along the coast and who were to some extent corrupted by the trade, this lucrative trade in people.
So, you know, much of the focus of this book is on the French relation involvement, because this sword that you look at, this particular gift that is central to the book, was a gift from French traders. So would you give a little background on how the French first got involved in the slave trade in this region?
Yes, like the French, then they started then already then in the then by, I would say that already by the late, then there were some French voyages to African coasts then in the late 16th century. Then, but this, the French then came mainly during the 17th century to the region that is the Bight of Benin. Then they were trading, then purchasing people to transport them to the Caribbean at this point. Then they joined the trade in Africans, as all the other European powers did, in order to supply then their colonies in the Americas with with an enslaved workforce that was basically gradually replacing then the enslaved indigenous populations in the Americas. Then the French, they were based mostly on West Africa, then in the region where is present day Senegal. They were also present in the region of the Bight of Benin, but they were able also to expand up to West Central Africa in the region that is the north of the Congo River. Then they were not present in the regions that were controlled by the Portuguese, that was Luanda and Benguela south of the Congo River, but they were able to trade on the Luangwa coast, because this was a zone where no European power took over. Then there were just several European powers trading in these areas, which is a characteristic that we do not see south of the Congo River, where the Portuguese had the control. Here, no European power had the control. All of them were trading in enslaved Africans. They were competing among themselves, and sometimes even nationals from the same kingdom, which is, it was the case of France, they were competing among themselves to see who were those who would get the best captives and more captives for the best prices. But also they could not establish, for example, any permanent structure in this area north of the Congo River. For example, if you take the example of Ghana, present-day Ghana, or even the region of the Bight of Benin, the European powers, they were able to construct, for example, forts in general, even castles. In this area, they couldn't do that. But the French then found in this zone a rich market then where they could purchase enslaved people and where no European power had a control in order to export them, especially to the colony at the time, the French colony of Saint-Domingue that became then Haiti in 1804. Then this is how the French joined this trade in enslaved Africans in this area.
Another a key place in the French trade was the city of La Rochelle. What did this how did this city function as a kind of a focal point of the slave trade?
Yeah, then this is it's an important question because La Rochelle is the second, then overall during the entire period of the Atlantic slave trade, if you take the number of captives, the number of voyages that left from La Rochelle to the African coasts, La Rochelle was the second busiest or most important French slave trading port. This is just after second to Nantes, which is the first slave trading port. Then La Rochelle is a city that is based on this northwest area of France. Then with then easy access to the Atlantic Ocean, then the city became then the second slave trading port. Then we calculated today, historians estimate that more than 166,000 voyages to the Atlantic coasts of Africa were departed then from the port of La Rochelle. After that, of course, the first slave trading port is Nantes. Nantes also sent Nantes traders also sent then voyages and slave ships to the area of the Luangwa coast. And in the case of Nantes, you are referring to about 500,000 enslaved Africans that were transported to the Americas through these voyages organized in the port of Nantes. Then La Rochelle was, of course, then a small city back in the time, but most that an important part of the economy in La Rochelle was around then the Atlantic slave trade. Then mayors, for example, of the city, as we can find perhaps in other slave trading ports such as Liverpool, were involved in the Atlantic slave trade. Then the wealthy individuals in the city, they were traders who were transporting, then were sending ships to the Caribbean to bring commodities to different commodities to La Rochelle, but they were also sending sometimes the same ships in other voyages to the Atlantic coasts of Africa in order to provide enslaved Africans then to the Caribbean. Then not only in La Rochelle we have these individuals who are politicians then who had political power locally, and these were entire families, then men, brothers, they would this families they would intermarry, then families involved in the Atlantic slave trade, and they would also own plantations in the Caribbean, especially in Saint-Domingue. Some of them they established companies, they would have representatives in Saint-Domingue. Then here we have that idea of the triangle, the triangular trade to some extent. And these men in La Rochelle, most of them were Protestants at the time. They were pretty much involved in this trade in enslaved people and people around them, because we think in terms of those who are the owners of the plantations. We think in terms of those who were the owners of the slave ships and who organized these expeditions to Africa. But around them, there were sailors, there were ship surgeons, there were ship captains who also became wealthy in this process of participation in the Atlantic slave trade. Then there was the entire city that, to some extent, supported the this trade, as we see perhaps in other parts of the Americas, in Rhode Island here in the United States, or we see also in Liverpool, in Bristol, and then or even in Amsterdam.
You focus on some of the individuals involved, important, ship owners and captains, that were involved in the trade. Can you tell me about these individuals, and what they the sort of the role they play in the story, broader story that you tell in this book?
Well, they play an important role because then we have several levels of actors. Then, for example, there is one family, the Garrichet family, that is the ship owner that sends this the two slave vessels to La Rochelle that are that make a great part of the story in the book. The Garrichet family, for example, then several they for several generations they were involved in the Atlantic slave trade as ship owners. Then we needed to have a lot of money then to own slave ships. They also had people, of course, who were the owners of enslaved people as well, then in the Caribbean, and they own plantations. In addition to that, then this is one level of this participation in the Atlantic slave trade. Garrichet himself, as far as I know, he hasn't been to Africa, but just below him, they had to hire then ship captains to lead these expeditions. And these should be men who were men of their trust, because the ship captains, they had the latitude to make a number of decisions during these slave voyages, including even the place where, of course, the ship was, when the ship was outfitted, it was supposed to go to a particular area in West Africa or West Central Africa. But once there was some latitude or where to anchor, where to send other boats to purchase enslaved Africans. Then the ship captains were very important as well. And some of them, they became very rich, which is the case of one of the ship captains that I explore in the book, that is Jean-Amable Le Sen. Then, and these were men who made several voyages to the coasts of Africa. Then they would spend several months on the African coasts, in which they would know the local actors, including these intermediaries such as the Mufuka. Then they are the ship captains, they are at the highest rank in the slave ship, but these are men who go to Africa several times, unlike this ship owners who stay then in Europe. Of course, that at some point, these ship captains, they purchase slave ships as well. At some point, they purchase plantations in the Caribbean. Then, in other words, they become wealthy, very wealthy men. But below them, there are other individuals that are important. Of course, the different members of the crew. But for example, there are ship surgeons who were then the medical doctors of sorts back in the time. Then these were individuals who were trained to then to deal with the different dimensions of healthy issues that could happen in the during the voyages, either related to the crew or the enslaved people who would be embarked in these slave ships. Then all these individuals were coming from the same regions, if not from the city itself, but from the neighboring areas. They knew each other. They married then people that they knew and that were also part of this trade, which makes this their community to some extent very small because they knew each other. On the other hand, some of them, they were traveling very far and having a real contact with African communities, at least along the coast where they were based for a number of months.
You discuss how part of this, you know, the crucial to this contact is this relationship with the Mufuka. So, you know, looking at the ceremonial sword that, you know, first really inspired this project, could you talk about this sword, you know, why it was created, who it was given to, really what its general purpose was?
Yes, and the ceremonial sword is a gift. Then, of course, you could discuss here for a very long time. Then I hope that you read the book to then that people who are listening to us, that they read the book to know more. But the sword is a gift that is given to this Mufuka by French slave traders that reached the region in first time 1775, and following a conflict with other slave traders, French slave traders as well, they want to thank the Mufuka who basically saved the lives of then of a captain and some members of the crew, and then they commission this sword that is a silver sword. And the silver sword has a dedication. If you look on the cover of the book, that the dedication is to the just of Cabinda, who is the Mufuka Andri Pukuta, which is the name that appears in the sources referring to him. And this is a gift then to thank him for saving their lives, but also a gift that wants to continue this relation, this commercial relations and perhaps preferential relations with this minister of commerce that was the Mufuka. Then perhaps an invitation for that in the next voyages to the region, that these captains would be favored with good captives, captives that were healthy. And then it's a gift to say thanks, and also to expect something in return after, then in the next next voyages. Then it was created in La Rochelle, but then in the book I retrace who was the silversmith who created the sword. And the sword, the format of the sword, then the sword had several layers, but the format of the sword is inspired then from what by locally made swords in the region of the Luangwa coast. Then the a great part of the book is a discussion about who created, who are these individuals who created, who commissioned, then how it was made, which elements on the sword, what do they refer to? Then this is part of the work that I did with by analyzing this this sword.
Yeah, I think you know, for listeners that are interested in learning more about, you know, the sword and the specificities of the journey, I definitely highly recommend checking out the book, because it is, it's very interesting the way in which you traced it and the sort of the journey that it took. I think for you, in terms of studying this this sword, was there anything that you found, you know, particularly surprising when you learned more about its journey?
I would say that the most fascinating element that I find about this object is that we think in terms of objects and things that are material items in the Atlantic slave trade or any other exchange. We think them in terms of that they move. Of course, they need people to move them, to create them. But the element that I found interesting is that we are used as historians to look at the written archive to find evidence. And of course, this book is based on research in the archives that are traditional archives, written archives. But the element that I find fascinating here is that the object itself has all these layers referring to the interactions that occurred among Africans and Europeans during the period that it was created and following then, including then the 19th century. Then the object itself became a repository and has all these layers imprinted on it. And usually we would think that objects are things that are static. And indeed, the silver objects already in Africa, there was already this tradition of amending silver objects, or in Europe, there are entire collections that would be melted in periods of need in order to create other objects that were more fashionable. But here, this object remained as it was when it was created, but there were layers that were added at the same time while preserving the older layers. And I think that this is the fascinating element here, to show how objects, they are alive and how much they can tell us about the history of these human atrocities, which is the case of the Atlantic slave trade.
I'm wondering also, you know, if there's other, findings that you had, because I think, and this is something that you talk about in the book, is you know, with doing a micro history, focusing on something very specific, or you know, focusing on a very specific region, a very specific period of time. For you as a historian, could you talk a little bit about just like the general value of doing something like a micro history, especially for understanding a topic as large, as expansive as the Atlantic slave trade and European colonialism?
Thank you. This is an excellent question. I sometimes have a difficult time with the micro history label, because it's micro from the point of view of the, I would say that we decide to start from a micro point of view. But in this story of the Atlantic slave trade, there are so many social actors involved, and there are people of different cultures, and also in terms of the time frame is so large. And here the time frame is large because we have the 18th century, and then the sword continues moving during the 19th century, when we are going to have European conquest in West Africa and West Central Africa. Then the micro explodes to some extent at some point. I think that what this kind of approach allows us to do is to not be lost within this very big context, but to use the micro to connect these different things, different times and spaces, in a way that follow only one thread. And of course, here, even just by following this thread, we have so many other threads that could have been followed during the writing of this book. Then I think that this is the advantage, is that you can really focus on many different things, but using only one example. I also think that how useful this kind of approach can be, if you think in terms of our museums today, here in the United States, the Smithsonian, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Brooklyn Museum, and different other private museums, or museums in Europe, in the Netherlands, Portugal, the Britain, France. There are so many objects in these museums, and when you go to these museums, you see sometimes this overwhelming number of objects being exposed, and we learn sometimes very little about each of these individual objects. And I think that a story like this shows us that one single object can open up so many windows to understand different societies across different times. And I believe that this is why perhaps is one of the advantages of doing this kind of history. Of course, not all objects have all this. It's not possible to follow all objects in terms of such an interesting history and such a documented history, because sometimes we have objects that we do not have so much traces or documents about them. I think that this kind of research, I think that offers that possibility. And I hope that encourages more people to do similar kinds of works, and especially to consider material culture as then a dimension that deserves to be part of the work that historians do, because to this day, most of this work has been done, especially by archaeologists, sometimes by anthropologists and art historians. But historians, they are very, they don't explore much material culture. And I think that they should do that.
Yeah, I think your art history background certainly helps bring that level of perspective, even just to I think to go into a museum exhibit, see an artifact, and ask so many unending questions, and then that you end up building an entire historical narrative around this single object. It's really an interesting way that those looking for projects might think about how they can build their own history around an object, around materials, and really that there's so many unending expansive questions that you can ask around these things. Well, Anna, thank you so much for being a guest of the New Books Network. The book is The Gift: How Objects of Prestige Shaped the Atlantic Slave Trade, Colonialism. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Khalid. Thank you for having me. Thank you.